Get in your meditation posture that you usually take. And then take a few deep breaths and relax. And focus your mind within. So then, at the beginning of any Dharma activity or any activity, in order to make that activity virtuous, it depends on the motivation. So it's very important to generate a virtuous or a positive motivation. Of course, the highest motivation is that of bodhicitta, the wish to achieve full enlightenment, to oneself achieve full enlightenment expressly in order to benefit all sentient beings. So if you already know how to generate that motivation, then do so. And one way to generate bodhicitta, or another way to generate a motivation, is to think about the four noble truths. So to think about the suffering of sentient beings, the causes of suffering, and then the cessation, the possibility of cessation of suffering and its causes, and then the path leading to that cessation. So whichever way you like to meditate, then spend a couple minutes to generate a positive motivation. Okay, so then with that motivation, then we'll do the refuge and bodhicitta prayer first. So before we do that, then visualize the field of refuge in the space in front of you. Usually we visualize Shakyamuni Buddha seated on a golden throne, upon which is an open lotus blossom. And then Buddha's surrounded by many Buddhas, Shakyamuni Buddha surrounded by other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And he's the one essence with your own spiritual teachers of this life, especially His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and so forth. And then in front of each of the beings of the refuge field is a low table upon which sits a Dharma text representing the Dharma jewel, the teachings of Buddha. And then you can visualize also them surrounded by many members of the Sangha, the ordained Sangha, or the Arya Sangha, the actual Sangha. So these represent the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So then before we go for refuge, we should generate the attitude of refuge, which is that the three jewels of refuge have the power to protect us from the sufferings of samsara, especially the sufferings of future lives, and all the suffering throughout samsara. And they have the ability to lead us to liberation and full enlightenment. And then usually when we recite the refuge and bodhicitta prayer, we visualize ourselves surrounded by all sentient beings. So it's good to visualize people whom you dislike or have a difficult time getting along with directly in front of you. And then friends and family seated behind you. And then all strangers, all the other sentient beings in the world whom you don't class particularly as friends or enemies, seated all around you, all in the form of human beings. So then we think we're going for refuge in order not only to free ourselves from suffering and to create merit for ourselves, but for the benefit of all sentient beings, upon whom our every happiness depends. So then we'll recite the refuge bodhicitta prayer twice in Tibetan and twice in English. Sangye chorong sogye chonam la jangche bade dani kyabze chi dagi jenso gibe sonam ki trola benje sangye rubar sho sangye chorong sogye chonam la jangche bade dani kyabze chi dagi jenso gibe sonam ki trola benje sangye rubar sho. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. And then we'll recite the four immeasurable prayers three times. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings from suffering and the cause of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And then we'll recite the seven limb prayer on the next page. It's page 2, the top, in English. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of psychic existence, and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. And then we'll recite the short mandala offering prayer. Sāyī pūkī jūyī shē mē tō trāṁ rī rāṁ līng jī nī ndē yāṁ pā nī sāṁ gē jīndū mē tē. So I'd like to say, first of all, I'm very happy to be here and to be here with you all. And I really, I'm very happy that you have this Dharma Center in North Carolina, in Raleigh. Although I've been studying at Sarah for some time, but I still don't feel very qualified to teach or like I know very much or have very much experience practicing Dharma. But Geshe Gelug, who's been teaching here for a very long time, and for whom I have great respect, because it's very hard for someone like him, I think, being from a different culture, to be here in the United States teaching the Dharma. But he does so selflessly, you know, for the benefit of others. So he requested me to give a talk. So for that reason, then, I came to give this talk tonight. So, so the talk will be about compassion and trying to how to meditate on compassion, I guess. So I'll basically try to recollect some things that I've heard His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Lamas of Rinpoche teach when I've been to their teachings. Right? So I'd like to start with a quotation. There's a tradition in Tibet to start a Dharma talk with a quotation first. So I'll do that. So this is from the Compendium of Teaching Sutra, spoken by Shakyamuni Buddha. So it goes like this. I'll read it twice and then explain the meaning. Bhagavan, if bodhisattvas grasp and know one teaching, they will have all of the Buddha's teachings in the palm of their hand. What is this one teaching? It is great compassion. For example, Bhagavan, once there is a life force, all other sensory faculties will exist. Bhagavan, similarly, once great compassion exists, all other bodhisattvas' qualities will appear. Okay, so again, I read it twice because usually if you've been to Dharma teachings by Tibetan lamas, they give a lot of quotations. So usually most of the Dharma teachings I've received have been in India. And usually the teachers are very high lamas, and they give a lot of quotations because they have incredible memories. They can remember all these verses from scripture. And they're quoted in Tibetan, but usually they quote it very fast. And they at the end, they kind of say, yeah, you know what that means, right? Because so many of the people in the audience are all these Tibetan monks who have the quotation and memory, have heard the explanations of before, and they remember it, and they know what it means. But I'm always sitting there like, no, I didn't know what that meant, and I didn't even understand what you said. So whenever I give a quotation, I like to read it twice to give you a chance to get it. Okay, so again, Bhagavan, if bodhisattvas grasp and know one teaching, they will have all of the Buddha's teachings in the palm of their hand. What is this one teaching? It is great compassion. For example, Bhagavan, once there is a life force, all other sensory faculties will exist. Bhagavan, similarly, once great compassion exists, all other bodhisattvas' qualities will appear. Okay, so there he's talking about the importance of the great compassion, how important great compassion is for developing all the other qualities of a bodhisattva. So most of the qualities of a bodhisattva can be subsumed into the six perfections, the practice of the six perfections, which are the perfection of generosity, the perfection of morality, the perfection of patience, the perfection of joyous effort, the perfection of meditation, and the perfection of wisdom. So he's saying great compassion, it leads to the practice of all those other perfections, or acts as a basis for all of those. And then he gives an example for how compassion acts in that way. So the example that I think you probably won't understand, so that I'll explain the example first and then match it up to the actual meaning. So he gives the example of the sensory, once there is a life force, all other sensory faculties will exist. So there's two things. Once there's a life force is the basis, and then all the other sensory faculties will exist. So the sensory faculties are like our eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and our faculty of seeing, or you could say our faculty of sight, our faculty of hearing, our faculty of smelling, faculty of tasting, and faculty of touch, of feeling things. So how does the life force act for a basis of those? So this is it's actually talking about rebirth, when we take birth. Or if you don't believe in rebirth, just when we take birth. When a person is born, actually I wanted to ask first, how many of your old students and how many of you are brand new students? How many of you are brand new? Okay. So I kind of want to keep things balanced. So I don't bore the old students and I don't lose the new students either. Right? But if you ask questions, that'll be helpful because I don't know. So when a person is born, actually we say first the physical cells, the sperm and egg of the father and mother come together. So that's the physical basis. So from those cells, they multiply and then our physical body arises, right? But according to Buddhist philosophy, the stream of consciousness, it has no beginning. So the first moment of consciousness in this life came from a previous life. But so the consciousness and the life force go together. So according to Buddhist philosophy, then, when the cells meet, the physical cells, which are the basis for the physical body, they're conjoined with a stream of consciousness and a life force. So the life force actually is like a very subtle energy that goes together with the consciousness. So once that life force then enters the cells, then that acts as the basis for being able to then develop the ability to experience visual phenomena and hear things and taste things and feel things with the body. And smell things. I'm missing one. Yeah, smell things. So, right, so the life force then enters at the time of conception and then gives rise to the ability to experience all the things in the external world, right? So similarly, then, great compassion here the life force is the analogy for great compassion. Similarly, a bodhisattva, they practice compassion. And then based on that practice of compassion, they naturally engage in acts of generosity, where they give things to others, give away, you know, their wealth, their time, their energy, their attention, in order to benefit others. Because they see that, okay, so this leads us to actually what is compassion? Because if we don't understand what compassion is, then we won't understand how compassion can give rise to all the qualities of a bodhisattva. Right. So, usually the two fundamental attitudes in Buddhism are love and compassion. Love is a little more simple. Love is, but they're very, very similar. Right? So that's why I'll talk about them both together. Love is, basically, the love is the wish for oneself or others to have happiness, to be well, you know, to enjoy, to have satisfaction, to have physical or mental health, you know, to be happy, basically, in the broadest term of happiness, every kind of happiness. So love is wishing oneself or others to have happiness, to be well. Compassion is the wish for oneself or others to be free of suffering, to not suffer, right? Because, so these are the two fundamental attitudes in Buddhism, or not only in Buddhism, I think you could say the two fundamental attitudes in all the world's religions or wisdom traditions. Because, so why are these two fundamental attitudes? Because these are the fundamental aspirations that all living beings, all living creatures have, whether they be humans or animals or other kind of creatures. We all wish to have happiness, you know, we all want to have a good life. We all want to enjoy life. We don't want to suffer or feel pain or sick, you know, physical or mental sickness or difficulty or problems, right? You can see even very tiny insects. If there's something that, if we put our finger near them, then they don't recognize it. They're afraid of it. Then they'll run away from it because they're afraid of being harmed. And if there's some food that they think it has a very good taste, like for ants, you can put a bit of sugar out, and they're very attracted to that. So they come to that because they know it's going to nourish. It's going to nourish their life, right? So all creatures, humans or animals or others, they want happiness, they want well-being, and they don't want to be harmed. They don't want to suffer, right? So because of that, then the two fundamental attitudes, and it's just common sense that the two fundamental attitudes, because we ourselves are like that, and we can see other people are like that. So then the two, it's common sense that the two fundamental attitudes we should have are wishing that. Just as we wish happiness for ourselves, we should wish happiness for others. Because the other's right to happiness is no different than ours. We're equal in that regard, in having a right to happiness. And our own wish to be free from suffering is no different than others. So just as we don't wish to be harmed, we wish not to be harmed, then others also wish not to be harmed. So love and compassion are these two wishes, you know, for ourselves or others to have happiness or well-being. For ourselves or others is love. And then for ourselves or others to be free from suffering. Is compassion. So, compassion, then, you can kind of see how compassion requires a little bit more intimate understanding of another person's situation. Because it requires us to understand that they are suffering and what kind of suffering they experience. Whereas love can be a mere wish for, you know, other people's happiness without really knowing what's going to make them happy. Compassion has to see the suffering that other people experience, oneself or others experience. So that requires a little bit of wisdom and like empathy, a little bit of getting inside that person's experience, like walking in that other person's shoes, knowing something about their experience. So the more we know about another person's experience, then the more we know about what particular kinds of suffering they have, then the more rich our compassion for them. And realistic, our compassion for them can be, right? So, So basically, I'll get back to the different bases for compassion later, meaning different kinds of suffering, based on which we can develop deeper and deeper levels of compassion. But now I just want to go back to this analogy, right? So just as the life force is the basis for all of our sensory experience, then he's saying in this quotation, compassion is the basis for all of the bodhisattva's qualities, right? So you can imagine then, when a bodhisattva, they see other sentient beings suffering, then one reaction could be to practice generosity. If they see other people being hungry, other people who are suffering from hunger, then they offer food. They see others suffering from poverty, they try to offer wealth or create a situation where those people can be more prosperous. If they see others suffer from being... So that's the perfection of generosity. And then the second perfection is the perfection of morality, practicing morality. So morality is basically not harming others. Not physically or mentally harming others. So if a bodhisattva has compassion, then they wish others to be free from suffering, then naturally they would check their own actions to see if their actions are going to cause harm to others or not. So naturally they would refrain from harming others as much as possible. And then if someone has compassion, also that would cause them to practice patience, right? The third of the six perfections is the perfection of patience. So what is patience? I won't go into detail here, but the main patience we're talking about is in response to anger, or is the opposite of anger, is not getting angry, right? Especially when others are harming us, right? Especially when others are verbally or physically or in some other kind of roundabout way harming us, then instead of responding with anger, instead of responding with the wish to harm that other person, practicing patience, like not responding with anger, not responding with the wish to harm. So you can imagine if someone has compassion towards a certain individual and then that individual harms them, then they'll naturally, because compassion is the wish for that person not to suffer, right? So they won't respond with anger. They'll be less likely to respond with anger, which is the wish to harm the other person, because the two intentions are completely opposite, right? The wish to harm or the wish not to harm, right? And then if someone has compassion also, then they want to free others from suffering. So they check to see what can I do, you know, to free others from suffering. And then that gives them great energy, you know, to engage in all different kinds of actions so that's joyous perseverance, or joyous enthusiasm. There's great energy for practicing, great enthusiasm and energy and kind of excitement about engaging in virtuous actions, right, to benefit oneself and to benefit others. And then the last two perfections is a little more difficult to see how they're related to great compassion, because they're based more on understanding what are the causes of suffering, right? So according to Buddhism, then the final cause of suffering is grasping at self, truly existent self, grasping at true existence, grasping at a sort of concrete sense of a self, which creates duality between self and others. And then, you know, based on that sense of self, then we generate attachment for things we like and aversion, anger towards things we don't like. So a bodhisattva having great compassion for others, wishing all sentient beings to be free from suffering, then they investigate to see what are the causes of sentient beings suffering. What are the most fundamental causes of sentient beings suffering? So if we look at the life story of Shakyamuni Buddha, we can see how he lived this kind of story, right? Shakyamuni Buddha grew up as a prince in northern India, very affluent, fortunate, affluent. He was in a royal family, right? He was a prince. So he, from the time he was a child, probably from his practice in previous lives, then he naturally had compassion for all the animals and the human beings and the children and the old, the elderly, the sick, the poor, all the people that he saw in the environment around him. There's a famous story where he left the palace gates three different times, four different times, led by his charioteer, to see the world as it really was, because his father was trying to protect him from seeing all the suffering of the world. Seeing sentient beings suffering with sickness, old age, and then the suffering of death, then his response was to leave the home life, leave the palace, and leave the sort of privileged life of a prince and go into the forest and meditate to try to find out what is the most fundamental cause of these sufferings of sentient beings. Not only sickness and old age, but even death itself. So finding the cause of death means finding the cause of rebirth, which leads to, you know, a life that in which one experiences those kind of sufferings. So the fundamental cause that through years of meditation, that he arrived at was this grasping and a sense of self, truly existent self. Right? So then to eliminate, so a bodhisattva having compassion for all sentient beings, similarly they would seek to find what is the cause for the suffering of myself and the suffering of other sentient beings. So then they would arrive at the same conclusion, it's a sense of self. So then the question is, well, how to eliminate that misperception of a self, that misconception, that wrong way of holding on to sense of self. So if they see that it's the truth of the non-existence of an inherently existent self or emptiness, then to actually eliminate that ignorance grasping requires a very focused mind. So this leads us to, it's kind of a very long path, leads us back to the perfection of meditation, right? The fifth of the six perfections. Perfection of meditation and the perfection of wisdom, right? Wisdom realizing emptiness. So if you didn't understand the last part there, don't worry about it. That's quite complicated. But, now we'll go on to more easy things. Are there any questions so far? I should check. Not about emptiness. We won't go into that now. No. If not, then, okay. I'll keep talking for another half hour at least. I'll just talk a little bit more and then we'll do some more meditation. Okay. So we're focusing on compassion, right? So compassion, again, is the wish for oneself or others to be free from suffering. So then again, this requires an understanding of suffering, you know, of seeing suffering. Otherwise, it's just words, right? So when we're trying to, and compassion always has sentient beings as its object. It always has people, human beings or animals or other kinds of living beings. Not plants, but animate beings, beings with a consciousness, right? It always has beings with a consciousness or people as its object, right? So we're always observing. That means that when we have compassion, we're focusing on an individual person or a group of people and generating the wish for that person or that group of people to be free from suffering, right? So now I wanted to talk about compassion in relation to the three different kinds of suffering. Right? For some of you old students, you might be familiar with the suffering of suffering, the suffering of change, and pervasive compounding suffering. So if you're not familiar with that, then we'll go through them one by one and practice meditating on compassion in terms of those. Let me just make sure I'm not leaving out anything first. No. Okay. So first, the suffering of suffering. So, there's one other thing. When we go to meditate on compassion, it's very important to first start with meditation on equanimity, a sense of equanimity. Because if we don't, then our compassion will be biased. We'll have more compassion for people we like and less or no compassion for people we don't like. Right, so as a spiritual practitioner, we're trying to generate a sense of a unity of ourselves with other sentient beings and the entire universe, right? So that requires a sense of equanimity. So first we try to, when we visualize, when we go to meditate on compassion, we should try to reduce our sense of dislike for people that we consider like enemies, people whom we tend to get angry at, we tend to get irritated towards, people whom we only see faults in their actions. We should try to reduce our sense of our sense of animosity or aversion towards those people. And then people whom we idealize, we only see positive things about, we have great attachment towards. We should try to reduce our sense of attachment for them. And people whom we consider strangers, whom we don't ordinarily care about or not interested in, we should try to generate more of a sense of affection for them. So, here I won't go into detail, but I just wanted to mention that when we're meditating compassion, we should do so. We should try it. I mean, ideally, we'll generate compassion towards all sentient beings equally, without leaving out enemies, and without only being only focusing on people we don't like. Okay. So then, meditating on compassion in relation to the suffering of suffering. So the suffering of suffering is like an open wound. Say we have a wound on our arm or a leg. Then anytime something touches it, it hurts, right? So there's pain there. So suffering of suffering are painful sensations, painful feelings, you could say, painful feelings. Painful feelings of physical, like when we're sick, when we have a headache, stomach ache, or a mosquito bites us, when we have an itching sore. Then those feelings, that feeling of pain, is the suffering of suffering. Similarly, mental, there's mental, so that's a physical feeling. Then there are also mental feelings, right? When we feel sad or depressed, or like a failure, or kind of low self-esteem, or even when we feel angry and our mind is very disturbed and agitated, or when we feel jealous, all those mental feelings of pain and anguish that we want to get rid of, that disturb the mind or bring darkness to the mind, all those are also the suffering of suffering, right? So the suffering of suffering is what we ordinarily consider as like pain or problematic or dissatisfaction or suffering, right? So the way to generate compassion in relation to the suffering of suffering is very simple, right? So first, usually we start with ourselves. We observe our own suffering, the physical or mental suffering, and then as we observe our own suffering, we just generate the wish, may I be free from the suffering. Is that simple? It's very simple, right? We observe our own suffering and generate the wish, may I be free from that suffering. It doesn't mean we have to know exactly how that's going to happen, or when it's going to happen, or what's going to make it happen. But it's just the wish, just the simple intention, may I be free from that suffering. Because simply that aspiration is like the beginning of a road to a result, right? We don't have to see where the road's going, but we have to start going down that road, right? So first we start with ourselves, and then we expand to others, right? So it's good if you actually visualize others in the space in front of you. So usually it's easiest to start, when we start generating compassion towards others, to start with people whom we know well, because we're more familiar with their experience, their difficulties, their hardships in life. So our compassion for them can be much more realistic than someone whom we don't know, right? So it's good to start with someone we know and someone whom we already have a natural affection or sense of closeness for. So say like, someone in our family, a brother, sister, mother, father, or a friend or someone at work that we know or something like that. So then you visualize the person seated in front of you and you think, you try to imagine. If you can, it's best you can imagine you experience their suffering. You try to think, what kind of suffering, what kind of problems do they have, right? And then actually, it's best if you can not just be a third-person observer, but if you can try to imagine yourself in their place. Like, if someone who has bronchitis, and they're continually coughing, hacking up mucus, and have a very difficult time breathing, and can't sleep at night, and wake up in the morning, they're totally exhausted because they didn't get a good sleep, and they have to take all this medicine that tastes disgusting. And try to be very, use your imagination and try to make your understanding of that other person's suffering very realistic, right? So as you do that, then you just continually generate the wish, may this person be free from that suffering, right? And then you can move on to another person. So maybe you move on to, usually it's recommended, move on to someone. When we look at the classes of friends, enemy, and stranger, usually you start with someone, you start generating compassion towards others who are friends, and then move on to others whom you're not particularly friends or not enemies, just you have a neutral sort of feeling towards. So people who are a stranger. So it's good to start with just one person. You might think of someone you saw on the street today, or someone you saw on TV who you don't know, but you can imagine like some kind of what their life is like somehow. And then move on to enemies, actually. So here I wanted to focus on enemies, because it's quite easy to generate compassion towards friends and family and strangers. But it's a little more difficult towards enemies, right? Because we have a natural dislike. We have, when we think, usually people whom we consider enemies, then we have a natural kind of aversion. You know, we don't want to be around them, we don't want to talk to them, don't want to think about them too much. So here maybe it would help to give some reason like why we should generate compassion towards people whom we usually dislike. One reason is just because they experience suffering just like anybody else, like just like we do. And they have as much a wish to be free from that suffering as anybody else does. And they have as much a right to be free from suffering as anyone else. So why shouldn't we help them? You know, maybe because they've harmed us in the past is usually the reason we think of. But them having harmed us in the past doesn't mean that they don't have suffering and they don't want to be free from suffering, and that they wouldn't be a happier person and a person who's less likely to harm us or others in the future if they were free from suffering. So there's another reason. If the person who harmed us, and so we're angry towards them, if they didn't experience suffering, then they wouldn't have a reason to harm us. Like, see if that makes sense. I mean, you have to see in your own experience. But usually when we've been harmed by someone else, usually it's because they themselves are not in control of their own actions. They're under the control of their delusions, of their afflictive emotions, of the disturbing states of mind. Usually they themselves have been harmed by others, and that causes them to feel like a sense of hurt, and then they kind of, I don't know, the psychology can be very complex, and I don't want to get into that here, but I mean, you check in your own experience. I mean, you can imagine someone who harmed you in the past. Usually you can, and it's good here to start with someone who's harmed you in a mild way. If you jump right in and, you know, the person you hate the most or the person who's harmed you the most, then it'll be difficult to think of your relationship or your reaction to that person's anger in a different way, right? Because you'll just be overcome by the old sort of ways of reacting to that. So it's better to start with someone who's harmed you in a mild way and try to think of a different way and try to imagine, you know, the situation from their point of view. So one reason to generate compassion towards others who have harmed us is because if that leads to us doing something to relieve that person's suffering in actuality, then that person will be less likely to harm us or others again in the future. Another reason is that is for our own sake. If we continue to get angry at other people, one particular person or other people in general, then we're causing ourselves untold unhappiness. I mean, we can all see in our own experience when we become angry or irritated or agitated or dislike others, our own mind it causes unhappiness in our own mind. In that moment, we're not happy. We've probably all had the experience when we get really angry at someone and then we go to sit down to eat and we don't feel like eating, and even if it's really good food, we can't taste it. We don't enjoy it because we're just our minds just totally stirred up with anger. Or we try to even go to sleep and we can't sleep because our mind is just racing about, you know, how this person said that and did that and did that. And when I see them tomorrow, I'm going to say this and do that and that. Right. And so it destroys our own happiness, our own health. I mean, as you all know, probably many studies show that people who have chronic anger get angry again and again and again. It leads to heart problems, high blood pressure, and a shorter life. And less friendships, right? And people don't, we've all known people very hot-tempered or short-tempered. And, you know, generally we don't like to be around them. We try to avoid those people, right? So we ourselves don't want to be that person, right? So if we practice compassion towards those who harm us, then it reduces the force of anger. Even if we get angry, it's less forceful and it lasts for a shorter time. And we're less likely to get angry in the first place. Mm-hmm. I mean, here you can bring in all the faults of anger. I mean, all the faults of anger become causes for generating compassion, right? So, I mean, other faults of anger is that it destroys a huge amount of positive actions that we do, a huge amount of merit. In Chandrakirti, so here I'll quote from a text, right? I have to be kind of a little bit like a Tibetan Lama sometimes, right? In good quotations. but it's very important actually to to read and think about the contemplations from past Buddhist masters, because they've achieved something that we want to achieve. It's like if you go to medical school, I mean, if you want to learn to be a good doctor, you study from people who are good doctors, right? You don't just start like playing around with people's bodies and like giving them different kinds of medicine and cutting here and there, right? You first, beforehand, you go to study from the best doctors you can find. So similarly, if we want to be good, like, spiritual practitioners, whichever religion we're in, or even if we don't believe in any particular religion, if we want to be more, like, wise people with more compassion and more, more positive qualities, we should look to people in the past who have developed positive qualities, right? So for that reason, it's good to look at the works of past Buddhist masters and see how did they describe the importance of one quality or fault of a certain delusion, and then reflect and then see if that jives with our own experience, right? So anyway, in this quotation, Chandrakirti says that there's no negativity as heavy or as bad as anger, because anger, in one moment of anger, it's such a powerful negative, like, attitude or thought or emotion. In one moment of anger, it destroys, like, the positive merit we've created by practicing generosity and pure morality over hundreds and thousands of years, right? In one moment of anger. So we can see, I mean, if you look at your own experience, it makes sense, because you can see when we get really angry, it's a very, very powerful, like, emotion. It completely, like, it sort of fills our whole body, and our blood pressure goes up, and our face gets red, and our adrenaline gets pumping, and our mind becomes really focused and very, like, intense. Whereas when we, usually when we sit down to, like, go for refuge, it's kind of a wishy-washy, kind of flimsy sort of attitude. I mean, sometimes we can generate a really positive, virtuous attitude, but we have to put a lot of effort. Like, anger just pops up like that, you know, spontaneously. So, Yeah, so I've been talking a lot, right? So let's do some meditation now, right? So try to consolidate some of what you heard and practice. So we'll start like this, just like I described. So first, to focus on yourself. Recollect, try to come in touch with or identify your own experience of suffering, mental or physical suffering. And as you observe your own suffering, either now or in the past, as you observe your own suffering, then just generate the wish, may I be free from suffering, right? So do that for a few minutes, and then move on to a friend, right? Someone you know, a friend, you know, like family member, or someone whom you're close to. And then try to do as I explained earlier. Try to come in touch with their suffering. And as you observe their different kinds of suffering, then just generate the wish, may they be free from suffering. And then try to move on to an enemy then, because we don't have so much time, right? So spend about, say, 3 minutes each. 3 minutes with yourself, then 3 minutes towards a friend, and then 3 minutes towards an enemy. Right? So start now. Okay, let me stop. Stop the meditation. So are there any questions yet? Have you understood everything? Yes.
So part of being compassionate is not wanting to cause harm to others.
Yes.
So did everyone hear that? Part of being compassionate or it's not wanting to harm others, and I think I get that. So I guess the question comes to mind, is there ever a case where maybe doing harm in the short term would mean less harm in the long term? Maybe you're setting a healthy boundary.
Mm-hmm.
Is it?
Yes, there are.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a famous precedent that's always quoted from one of Shakyamuni Buddha's previous lives. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The situation is this. Like, imagine this situation. There's a ship full of merchants. They're going to trade to a foreign island to trade and then bring back their wealth, like, to home. So there's one person on the ship that wants to steal the possessions of everybody else on the ship. And he's planning to kill all the others and take all of their goods. And there's another person on the ship who has clairvoyance. And he knows somehow that this person is planning to kill all the others. So he sees that if that person is planning to kill all the others, if he does that, many people will suffer, right, because of that person's criminal intentions, right? And also that person will create a lot of negative karma. So from life to life, he'll take a rebirth in hell or some very suffering environment. He'll have a lot of problems in the future, that one person who's planning to kill the others. So that person, in order to both prevent others from being killed and also prevent this person from engaging in a very heavy negative action, he kills that person, actually. So this person who did that was in one of Shakyamuni Buddha's previous lives. So he's a very highly realized kind of person. So that's the sort of example of a situation where, yeah, it's okay to use forceful means is kind of the polite way of saying doing something really that's harmful to one person, but not with the intention to harm the person, with the intention to benefit another person. So the other example is like parents with their children. Sometimes if the child keeps going out and playing in the road, like a busy road, right? And then the parent says, you know, don't play there. You know, it's very dangerous. There are many cars going by. You might get hit. And then the child doesn't listen, like does it again. Then maybe at some point the parent can't just explain kindly, but really has to scold, you know, to make a strong impression, you know. Has to use very kind of forceful, wrathful, you know, show a very angry face and be like, you know, don't go do that or else, da, 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 da. And the intention is not to harm the child; it's to benefit the child. So what we have to be careful with is the intention. Like the intention should never be to harm others; should always be to benefit. But sometimes it has to look like ordinary harm, but actually the intention is to benefit.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Or comments? Could you follow the meditation? You can visualize, let's see. Bring to mind your own experience of suffering and then generate the wish to be free from that. Okay. If there's no questions, then we'll move on. I have a lot more to talk about. There's no shortage of things to talk about. So just to go over the main points so far, compassion is the wish for oneself or others to be free from suffering, right? To be free from suffering. So you have to observe someone's experience of suffering and then have the wish that that be gone, you know, that be eliminated. So one thing actually that came to mind while I was trying to meditate was that usually it said how much time we have? Okay, I'll go into a little detail. There's a question of this. This comes up because Sarah was telling me, Venerable Renee came recently and was teaching about calm abiding. how to generate calm abiding, concentration to calm abiding, and how that's related to actually achieving actual realizations. Like, without achieving calm abiding, you can't generate actual realizations. So I just wanted to, I'll connect this back, but I just wanted to explain kind of what that means. What is an actual realization, and then how that's related to compassion. So an actual realization is basically when a person actually enters the path. So in Buddhism, we say that you can divide people into two groups. You can divide sentient beings into two groups. Ordinary, let's say people who are not on the path and people who are on the path. So what does it mean to be on the path? It means to have an actual realization. Before you're on sort of the Buddhist path, there's five paths. There's the path of accumulation, path of preparation, path of seeing, path of meditation, and path of no more learning. Right? So that's just, you get the sound at least. You don't understand this. But So the first is the path of accumulation. So when you actually enter the Buddhist path, like the definitive path, is when you actually achieve a realization. So what does that mean here? If you look in terms of compassion, then you could say what that means is when you generate compassion to the degree that it arises spontaneously without any effort and continuously, all the time. So it's the same with renunciation. Actually, the definition of a path in Buddhism is an exalted knower, which is, you could say, an exalted knower which is embraced by or supported by uncontrived renunciation. So renunciation then is the wish to be free from all the suffering of samsara, right? Or the wish to achieve liberation, the suffering of samsara. So here again, there's contrived renunciation is what, when we generate renunciation, when we see like all the problems with taking rebirth through the force of delusion and karma, all the problems in samsara, and we generate a wish to be free from that, it's contrived. We have to put effort into generating that aspiration. Or similarly, when we generate the aspiration to become fully enlightened in order to benefit all sentient beings, it doesn't come about like anger or attachment, uncalled for. We have to put effort into generating that. So the point of actually entering the path is when you generate uncontrived renunciation or uncontrived bodhicitta, actually. So to generate that, You can imagine for compassion to arise continuously and spontaneously without any effort, day and night, you know, whether you're awake or asleep, you continuously have this wish for all sentient beings to be free from suffering. You can imagine to generate that attitude, you have to have focused your mind on that attitude, like at length, again and again and again, with great intensity, you know. So to generate that kind of focus and, or sort of absorbing oneself completely in that intention so that it becomes automatic, then you have to have, that's why you have to have calm abiding or concentration. Calm abiding, I mean, the mark of calm abiding is where you're able to focus your mind on one object without distraction whatsoever for 4 hours. And the mind just remains focused on one object. If you've actually generated calm abiding, then what you can do is, the ability you kind of get is you're able to focus your mind on the chosen object of meditation. So just like we're meditating now and we're focusing on this wish to be free from suffering. So you take one object of meditation, you focus your mind there, and then you're able to keep your mind placed there without distraction, without effort, and without it, your mind being distracted whatsoever, even for a split second, for 4 hours or longer. So you can imagine, I mean, you only achieve that with great practice, you know, great practice and great effort. But, I mean, step by step, anybody can do that. So that once you achieve that sort of ability, then you take that power of mental focus, and then you meditate on things like love, compassion, renunciation, emptiness. And then it quickly transforms the mind in a very powerful way, right? So the actual realization of compassion is when by focusing your mind on that wish for all sentient beings to be free from suffering again and again and again, then it becomes like second nature. It just that wish arises continuously and all the time, spontaneously and without effort, right? So that's, yeah, one thing I wanted to mention. There was another thing. I can't bring to mind now. Anyway, it'll come back. Okay, so I wanted to prepare you for our next meditation, the last meditation. So I mentioned earlier the three different kinds of suffering. So it's quite... So we talked about the suffering of suffering, right? What we usually consider as painful experiences. So that kind of compassion in relation to the suffering of suffering is not unique even to humans. Even animals have that kind of compassion. Like if you've ever observed, say, a mother dog or a mother cat and her babies, then when she sees the kittens or the little dogs suffering, then she wants to do anything she can to try to, you know, relieve them of the suffering. If they're hungry and they're yelping or barking or cats meowing, then she goes to milk them, you know, gives them milk or goes to find food. Or if they're lost and they can't find their way back to their nest, and she hears them kind of yelping or meowing, then she'll go find them and then bring them back to a place where they feel safe, right? So even animals have this kind of compassion in relation to the suffering of suffering. What's more difficult, and which animals don't have, so as humans we can uniquely do, is generate compassion in relation to what's called the suffering of change, right? And the suffering of, and pervasive compounding suffering, right? So the suffering of change, is this. So I'll just explain these two, and then we'll try to meditate on compassion in relation to these. So the suffering of change are actually pleasant sensations, pleasant feelings. Right, so whereas the suffering of suffering are unpleasant, painful feelings of body or mind, the suffering of change are actually what's called contaminated pleasant feelings of body or mind. So it's not that all pleasant feelings of body and mind are the suffering of change. Like, that would be a big bummer, right? Because then we couldn't enjoy anything at all. So the big exception, suffering, pleasant feelings that are not in the nature of suffering, are those which accompany a virtuous mind. Right, so you might have seen when you're like at the beginning when we were generating a positive motivation, or now when we're meditating on compassion, you might have felt you might have had a sense of pleasant experience along with that. You know, while we're focused on, you know, may I be free from suffering, may I be free of, you know, this sickness or this problem or this kind of mental anguish, the main part of the mind focused on that wish to be free from this problem or suffering. But we might notice there's a pleasant experience, right? There's pleasant feelings that go along with that. So those kind of feelings are not the suffering of change. Why? Because they can be increased infinitely without end, right? Because we can increase our compassion without limit. I mean, you try to think, like, there's a limit to, say, how far we can walk or how high we can jump or how much food we can eat, or maybe even there's a limit to how angry we can get. I mean, that's something we can check. But there's no limit to how much we can develop compassion, in the sense of both number of people, how many people we can have compassion for. There's no limit. We can widen the scope of our compassion wider and wider, and think of more and more and more people and generate compassion towards more and more people. Also, the amount of suffering we can, you know, however much suffering there is that we observe, we can generate compassion towards that. Also, the strength of our compassion, the intensity of compassion through practice, we can generate stronger, more intense compassion without any limit. I mean, that's one of the beautiful things about the mind, especially in the virtuous minds, is there's no limit to the degree to which you can develop it. Right. So the suffering of, so then if there's this pleasant feeling that goes along with the attitude of compassion, then that pleasant feeling can also increase as with the compassion. So that pleasant feeling, as long as you have, say you generate the actual realization of compassion that arises spontaneously and continuously all the time, and there's a pleasant feeling that goes along with it, then you naturally experience great satisfaction, great inner contentment, great happiness and joy together with that all the time. So that's why that sort of pleasant feeling is not suffering of change. When we talk about suffering of change, we're talking about pleasant feelings that arise usually together with attachment. So imagine most of us are attached to different kinds of food, right? So imagine your favorite kind of food, and you're eating it, and you have a pleasant sensation that goes along with that, right? But is that an unending source of satisfaction or pleasure? If you keep eating that food, it quickly becomes a source of suffering, actually. After a half hour or an hour, even your favorite food, you keep eating, you start to feel full. Usually it's something sweet, right? So you usually start to feel like icky and really full and then too full. And then it becomes like source of suffering. So that this is the activity is the same. But the feeling that goes along with it changes from one of enjoyment to one of suffering, right? So usually the classical example given is like, say you're sitting in the shade and then you're too cold. And then you move into a sunny spot, you know, move to some place where it's sunny, so you can get warm, right? At first it feels good, you know, you feel warm, oh, it's nice, warm here, feel warmer. But then the longer you stay there, you get too hot, right? It starts, so the experience, what you're actually doing is the same, sitting in the sun. But the feeling that goes along with it changes from one of being pleasant to one of being suffering, right? So then you move back to the shade, right? You get too hot, move back to the shade. And then at first it feels nice, very cool, but then you get too cold, right? So then you move back and forth. So all of our objects of attachment are like that, right? Whether it's food or another person or music or, you know, movement, say dance or driving or, you know, everything that we're like, all our objects of attachment, all our experiences of attachment, they go together. At first we experience this pleasant sensation. But then if we engage in that action too long, it becomes a source of suffering. So we have to change all the time. We have to keep racing around from one object to attachment to another without ever being satisfied and without ever gaining like lasting satisfaction. So that's why, I mean, the Buddhist kind of strategy for gaining lasting satisfaction is to engage in virtuous mental attitudes. I mean, satisfaction, happiness, joy is an experience of the mind, right? So as long as, and we can increase virtuous states of mind infinitely. And then, because virtuous states of mind never are accompanied by unpleasant sensation, unpleasant feelings. They're always accompanied by at least neutral, if not, I mean, usually very pleasant mental experience. So then, I mean, if you can imagine, I mean, a Buddha is someone who's completely perfected every positive virtuous state of mind. So they have continually have just only virtuous states of mind arising, you know, wisdom, compassion, love, generosity, kindness, patience. And then with all of those, there's great joy that accompanies it, right? So that's kind of the Buddhist strategy for having lasting happiness. All right, so that was kind of a detour. So if we're going to meditate on the suffering of change, the way to do it then is to, and I also wanted to throw in the all-pervasive compounding suffering, as complicated as it sounds. It's important to understand a little bit. So we won't meditate yet, but I'll talk maybe 5 more minutes. So how to meditate on suffering of change is we start with ourselves. So again, we always start with ourselves and then move to others, right? When you move to others, you always move to someone you have some natural liking for first, and then move to someone who's neutral, and then move to someone who you tend to have dislike for. And then once you are engaged or generating compassion for those three people, then you can expand, you know, and make each of your groups bigger. And then gradually you can expand to all sentient beings, right? So if we start with ourselves, then we think of experiences of attachment that we have when we've been, you know, particular food we're attached to, and how that experience of enjoyment, you know, when we're having that food, how it can turn into, it doesn't last, you know. For one thing, it doesn't last. It's very temporary. And it can turn into experience of suffering, right? Or, you know, something else, maybe, you know, particular, I don't know, whatever you're attached to, try to see how it's temporary or doesn't last. And if you continuously engage in that action, it turns into a source of suffering. And then generate, as you see that, you can generate compassion for that process of attachment, you know, that kind of endless wheel of craving after things and attachment. I mean, the most extreme form of this is like an addict, you know, an alcoholic or a drug addict or someone who's addicted to alcohol or addicted to drugs or addicted to sex or addicted to fame or addicted to money or power or all those things. They're called addictions because they become problematic. at first there's an experience of success, you know. Oh, you know, I have a drink and it, you know, feels good and I feel good. But then it leads to problems. I mean, when you wake up in the morning, you have a headache, but also maybe you spend a lot more money than you thought you would, and then, you know, all kinds of other problems we all know about, right? So it can be the same with fame or power or, you know, attachment to wealth, right? That'll lead to problems. So here when we're generating compassion, we're not only looking at the actual problems, but at the earlier step in the process where there's this attachment and a pleasant sensation that goes with it, that doesn't last, right? And doesn't bring real satisfaction. It just brings a sort of temporary fix to our dissatisfaction, right? Maybe I'll just leave it there for now. I think all pervasive compounded suffering is quite complicated, and we don't have a lot of time, and we've talked about a lot already. Right? So why don't we do, say, 5 minutes of meditation on compassion, observing the suffering of change, right? Maybe you have any questions first? You understand what we're doing? Yeah, start with yourself and see how far you get. If you want, you can just spend the whole time on yourself. But if you like, you can move on to others. Yeah. Okay? Okay, let's start. So we'll do, say, 5 minutes. Okay, let me stop. So are there any questions yet? Yes, please.
In thinking about meditating on compassion, even if you're trying not to watch the news or whatever, there's so many examples of suffering around us.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been learning about how it's easy to feel compassion for the victim, but we really need to have compassion for the perpetrator of the violence as well.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about that, mm-hmm. you think how much that person must also be suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's just so easy to feel overwhelmed. You know, mm-hmm. How do we keep from getting overwhelmed
mm-hmm.
when we're trying to feel compassion for others?
Mm-hmm.
We're not realized enough to control our mind, I guess, and it can just feel really bad really fast.
Right. Feel really bad, like
overwhelming, like
what can I do? Or
yeah, it's like it
just
they
is
must
so
be
terrible.
Hurting so much, and there's nothing I can do, and this pain, their pain is. Must be so big, and it's just going to keep going, and they're accumulating more negative action by doing more abuse, and you know, and I can't stop it. What can I do? You know, it's overwhelming.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Sometimes it's kind of good to be overwhelmed, but not permanently, right? So, I think the most helpful thing is to just recognize that everything arises from a cause. Everything arises from a cause, right? So both the victim, the suffering that they experience, arises from causes. And the perpetrator of it, in a particular instance, the perpetrator of a crime, who's also a victim of something else that happened earlier, they also, I mean, their actions harming others, they also arise from causes, right? So, I mean, just thinking about impermanence and cause and effect, that the causes... I mean, things change, right? Basically, it's like that everything is in a state of transformation and change. So no situation will last forever. However negative it is, it won't last that way forever. And so there's always opportunity to change the situation in a better way, right? For a positive way. So sometimes if you're feeling overwhelmed, you should try to focus on that. Like, what can I do to create something, a positive cause, you know, a cause for something positive in the future, a positive cause and a positive result, both. What can I do? I mean, then you have a sense of like, yeah, the future is in my own hands. I mean, mostly it's difficult for us to affect others. That's very difficult. I mean, it's easy for us to change our own future because, I mean, here, especially if you think in terms of like law of cause and effect, I mean the karma, then our future experience will be the result of our current actions, our present actions, our past actions. So it's easier for us to achieve causes for our own future happiness, but much difficult to do so for others. But we can. I mean, the main way the Buddha teaches, I mean, not only the Buddha, any spiritual teacher benefits is by teaching. They can't, you know, they can't eliminate our own anger, our delusion, our confusion, our fear. They can't just like kind of reach in our mind and just wipe it out and replace it with, you know, compassion and wisdom and courage. But rather they can explain to us like why do we have fear? Why do we have anger? Why do we have ignorance? Why do we suffer? And what are the causes? And how can we eliminate those causes? So thinking about that everything arises from, everything's in a state of flux and change. Everything arises not randomly, not chaotically, but from specific causes. Just like apples only grow from an apple tree, and oranges only grow from an orange tree, right? So everything arises from specific causes. So, right? So there's a specific cause that we suffer, other people suffer in the world, And those causes aren't fixed. Like we can replace negative causes for negative results with causes for positive results. Right? So recognizing that, then it puts us more in the mode of like thinking, well, what can I actually do? You know, but we have to think on very long term. If we want to like eliminate all the hunger in the world or all the war in the world, I mean, which of course is great to have that aspiration to do that, but we have to be realistic in what we can do. Yeah. Does that help? Or do you have a follow-on question?
It helps a little bit. I just have to work on. I know that we can't do everything, but your suggestion, if I try to focus on that attitude, it can probably at least reduce that.
Yeah.
Overwhelming feeling.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I mean, a lot of people don't even think about the suffering of others. You know? That's much worse. I mean, at least you recognize that others suffer. You know? If more people meditate, I mean, if more people had more compassion, then there would be less. I mean, because human beings, we cause so many of our own problems. I mean, we have some problems caused by the natural environment, like natural disasters and so forth, and cold and heat and hunger and thirst and famine. But so many problems are caused by us, you know? By like socioeconomic inequality, wars, I mean like tobacco, so much in the food industry, you know, companies making things that harm other people. The people making those things, they know it harms other people, but through lack of compassion, like they just don't really care. They're rather more interested in profit, right? So, I mean, just having compassion and recognizing other people's suffering and having the wish, so there's one thing is recognizing other people's suffering and then having the wish that they be free from it. And then beyond that, having the wish that I myself can do something to free from it is the next step. So just having those is really excellent. I mean, just sometimes it's good when you feel overwhelmed, just rejoice that, wow, you know, I have a little bit of compassion and I have the wish to actually myself do something about it, which is excellent. So sometimes it's good to, you can just rejoice in that. That helps to not feel so overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. Yes. Please.
Thank you, Elise. On that note, can you just touch on who was Hitler that he created such horrors? What kind of a devil is this?
Yeah.
And what kind of karma did he have? I mean, it's astounding. If you just don't mind, give us a little insight. Who was he?
Yeah, I mean, Hitler was an Austrian guy, actually. I was just reading some stories about World War II veterans. My uncle is a World War II veteran, so I was just reading some of his story just today. But, yeah, there was a woman, actually. She lives in Iowa now, but she's from Germany. She grew up in Germany in Czechoslovakia. She was a German who moved to the United States. And she was kind of asking the same question. I mean, she just concluded he was just insane. I mean, a crazy guy. But I mean, if you think about it in terms of past and future lives and karma,
everybody, millions of people were hypnotized by him. It's like unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, that wasn't his own doing. I mean, there was a lot of, I mean, the people creating propaganda. I mean, it required a lot of people to have the whole, you know, Nazi sort of regime working the way it was. It was a lot of people who wanted, you know, they wanted some idol figure that would everybody could rally behind and all that. So, I don't know, I mean, the karma is to have, to have incredible hatred. I mean, from life to life, to have made one's mind incredibly attuned to anger and hatred. I mean, you can kind of imagine, like, if you're angry and you don't see anger as a fault, because many people see anger as a virtue, as like something that we should cultivate, because it's very, when we have anger, we suddenly, what do you say? We harness a lot of power. Suddenly we have a lot of power and a lot of strength and a lot of energy and a lot of mental focus, which is true, but it's all directed in a very negative way. So if someone just totally doesn't see anger as a fault, but they see it as something, as a sign of great strength and courage and like pride, then they're just familiar with that from life to life to life. And they also have, I mean, incredible, incredible lust for power, fame, you know, idolatry, all those things. And idolatry, I mean, other people worshipping. Yeah, I mean, you could imagine somebody becoming like that. Huh? So that's why it's important for us to recognize the faults of all those negative attitudes. Yeah. Not only so that we don't become like that, so that in our society, our society doesn't become like that, you know.
That it doesn't happen again.
Yeah, because Hitler was really a product of his society. I mean, this is, yeah. I mean, I don't want to go into all those historical details, but societies can be very different. I mean, I speak because I know, like, I live with Tibetan refugee settlement in India. So most of the people I see day to day and talk with day to day are all Tibetans, right? And in Tibetan society, like, anger is totally, like, everybody recognizes that anger is a really negative thing. It's like the worst of the worst. So, I mean, how does that play out? Like, a lot of times on the debate courtyard, we debate very intensely, and because it's always a competition. You're always trying to defeat your opponent. Not because you want to hurt him or make him embarrassed or something, but because you want to learn whether what the opponent's saying is true or not, and whether it stands up to logic and reasoning or not, right? So it's a very intensive kind of competition, and sometimes people use tricks. Like they know if they can make the opponent kind of upset or angry, that they won't think very clearly, and then they'll give answers that are mistaken, and then they'll lose their position, their philosophical position. But on the debate courtyard, if someone really gets angry, everybody will kind of look like, oh, yeah, he got angry, he really lost it. And then that person feels really embarrassed afterwards. Whereas in our society, I mean, I haven't lived in the U.S. for quite a long time, but in our society, I know if someone gets angry, people feel a little bit uncomfortable, but it's not like an automatic, oh, that was wrong. It's more like, well, was that right or not, or is that person justified or not justified, and something like that. So I'm not saying our society is wrong, but there's different. I mean, there can be a vast difference in the way a group of people like respond to the same emotional response.
As though it's okay.
Yeah, exactly. So. Any more questions or comments? Yes.
I'm just a little bit trying to understand the connection between change and suffering from change and attachment. You mentioned attachment when you were explaining it, and I'm not sure I'm clear.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'll try to clarify that. So, attachment is. Let's start with attachment, right? What is attachment? Attachment is basically attachment is when we observe something like a pleasant object. So here, when we say an object, we mean whatever we're focusing our mind on, right? Our attention on. So say it's some kind of food. Say it's like, I don't know, pizza or chocolate. Yeah, chocolate. So say we have attachment for chocolate. What does that mean? It means we observe chocolate, which is tasty. I mean, it's not disgusting, right? Chocolate is pretty good stuff. So we observe chocolate, but rather than just having an accurate appraisal for the ability of chocolate to satisfy us, we exaggerate chocolate's ability to bring us satisfaction. So we exaggerate the attractiveness of chocolate. So we have this. So when we have chocolate, we have this feeling like, oh, chocolate is sort of like, it's going to satisfy my every need. It's going to bring me like the best sort of enjoyment possible, and it'll never last. Like, and that potential for my enjoyment actually exists in the chocolate.
That's attachment.
Yeah, that's the view of attachment. Attachment is having this exaggerated sense of something's ability to satisfy us. It's unrealistic.
And then it changes.
Yeah.
And that causes suffering.
Well, yeah, the experience changes.
Too much of it.
Yeah, so when we start eating the chocolate, it's enjoyable. But if we keep eating it, it becomes, like, disgusting. Like, you could torture someone with chocolate. You just force them to keep eating chocolate. It would be, like, sickening. right? So the feeling, the first is a pleasant feeling. So that pleasant feeling is actually the suffering of change. It's in the nature of suffering. How do we know that? Because it changes into an unpleasant experience. The same, actually, continue with the same action, it changes into an unpleasant experience. Yeah. Is that clear? Okay. Yeah. Well, it's 8:30 now. I know you all have very busy lives. So probably have many things to get to. So thank you all for coming. I really enjoyed talking with you. I hope we meet again sometime. Oh, we should do some dedication prayers too before we end. So I think on the pink page in the prayer book, page 3. We'll just do the first section. We'll do the last verse for as long as space remains. And then we'll do His Holiness Long Life Prayer. And then we'll do Lama Zopa Rinpoche's Long Life Prayer in English. We'll just do those 3 verses. Okay? So you understand? You got it? For as long as space remains. And then His Holiness Long Life Prayer, Dalai Lama's Long Life Prayer, and then Lama Zopa Rinpoche's Long Life Prayer. Lama Zopa's Long Life Prayer. Down below. So first of all, just bring to mind all the merit we've created. From when you first had the motivation to come to Dharma teaching, a Dharma talk at Kadamba Center tonight, and then generating a motivation, a bodhicitta, a positive motivation, and then the virtue of listening to and engaging and contemplating and meditating on the Dharma. So not just yourself, but all the other people in the center. So rejoice in all the merit. And then rejoice in all the merit created by all of our teachers, especially His Holiness Dalai Lama and Lama Zopa Rinpoche. Think how wonderful. And then we rejoice in all the merit created by all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in the 3 times and 10 directions. So all this merit then we amass together and we dedicate with these verses. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjanath's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers honoring the 3 jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long.